disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Back in November 2018, you may recall that I released an episode about the Columbine High School massacre. You may have even taken the time to listen to it. Thank you so much if you did. Well, I wanted to follow that up with another episode, tonight's episode in fact, which focuses on the malefactors of that horrific incident. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. Two names that are synonymous with evil and tragedy. Now, to be clear, this episode is not in any way a glorification of the individuals we are about to discuss. They, nor their crimes, have no admiration from me or my team. Whilst previously we focused on the incident and the victims, tonight we are focusing on the perpetrators. Many may argue that their names should not be spoken. Individuals so heinous that they should be left to time and forgotten. But from a psychological standpoint, I think it's extremely important that we don't completely forget these individuals. We must learn from the horror that came before to ensure that it's not repeated. Unfortunately, society isn't doing just that. There have been over 800 school shootings in the United States alone since the Columbine High School massacre, with over 600 children either killed or seriously injured. Thoughts and prayers. And guess who, in more than 80% of cases, the killers claim their inspiration to carry out the attacks were? That's right, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris. But what made Columbine so special? What made Harris and Klebold such poster boys for murder and evil? Before we begin, let me just ask that if you enjoy what we do and you would like to support our work, please consider heading over to patreon.com/deadsouls and subscribing for just a few bucks. It really helps our research and our investigation work. Also, please give us a follow on both Instagram and Twitter. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. Now, let's get into it. This is The Mindless Menace of Violence. I'm always reluctant to use the word evil while talking about criminals and individuals who commit purposeful harm. The word evil is quite dramatic. It feels almost biblical in its presence and sound, even though it's derived from an old Germanic and emerged around 1050 AD. Evil seems grandiose and akin to maniacal, satanistic mass murderers, almost comic book fantasy. That said, some sorry souls do construct their psyche around the want to be just that. Around a need to hurt or kill for their own gratification, be it sexually, psychologically, or by some other internal necessity. I think Harris and Klebold, although not born evil, so to speak, certainly developed an immature fascination with darker elements in history and culture, which, along with psychological problems, developed themselves a need or a want to carry out the crimes that they did. In fact, what they had planned would have been even worse than the reality that unfolded in April of 1999. That is not to say what did happen wasn't grotesque in itself. On April 19th, 1995, two men, by the name of Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh, conspired to blow up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building at 200 Northwest 5th Street in downtown Oklahoma City. Timothy McVeigh, a domestic terrorist and anti-government militant, parked a Ford F-700 truck which he had rented from Ryder outside the front of the building. The truck was packed tight with explosives. McVeigh detonated the truck bomb, not before fleeing the scene. The impact of the explosion resulted in the building experiencing a total collapse which killed at least 160 people and injured a further 680. More than 324 other buildings within a 16-block radius were also destroyed or damaged in the blast, along with almost 90 vehicles, causing around $652 million worth of damage. Adjusted for inflation, this would be $1.2 billion today. The Oklahoma City bombing was the worst attack on American soil since the 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese Air Force, And it wasn't until 2001 when an even worse attack on US lands would happen with the 9/11 attacks. There was widespread repulsion at the atrocity across the United States and indeed the world at large. The attack seemed senseless and an unnecessary tragedy. No one of a sane mind could possibly comprehend what was going through the mind of the terrorists who committed this heinous act. Most people, but not all. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were around 14 years old at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, and even though they didn't take much notice of the events at the time, 4 years, almost to the day, later, they would use the bombing as one of their main inspirations. You see, on April 20th, 1999, best friends Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris are awake early. Certain documentaries and well-known media on the subject would lead you to believe that the pair went bowling early that morning. Whilst Eric and Dylan did participate in bowling classes at AMF Lanes, some 4 miles from Columbine High School, on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday mornings at 6 a.m, that day they were absent from the class, although strangely, both seen in the parking lot outside prior to the class starting. Anyway, I digress. Although a particularly beautiful, warm and sunny spring day in Littleton, Colorado, the day would be remembered for many other reasons. This is no ordinary day for the two boys. This is a day that for months Dylan and Eric had been planning. They referred to it by a code word to keep their plans secret. NBK they called it, after the movie Natural Born Killers. As per the official narrative, the two friends met the morning of April 20th at a local grocery store where Eric was seen purchasing a propane gas tank. This is considered the final preparation for their planned school massacre. For months the pair had been building IEDs, or improved explosive devices, if you will. They had been following instructions obtained from the Jolly Rogers cookbook, which they pulled from the internet. A veritable treasure trove and encyclopedia of recipes for weapons of mass destruction. Among their arsenal were 99 homemade pipe bombs, a High Point 995 carbine, a Savage 67H pump action shotgun, an Intratec Tech DC-9, a Stevens 311D double-barreled sawed-off shotgun, 4 knives, and several propane explosives set with timers. The boys took the gas tanks back to Eric's house at around 7 a.m. Then they split up. Eric prepared the final bombs and Dylan went to acquire gasoline. Everything was meticulously planned ahead of time, including a break for breakfast and to relax and mentally prepare. At around 11 a.m, the two made their way to Columbine High School on South Pierce Street in Littleton, Colorado. It was their school, and one they had both attended for several years. It was about to become the site of one of the deadliest mass shootings in modern United States history. Klebold and Harris drove separately to the school. On the way, they placed 2 backpacks with pipe bombs, aerosol canisters, and small propane tanks in a grassy open space 3 miles southwest of Columbine High School. They set a timer for 11:14 a.m. These explosives were intended as a diversion. Klebold and Harris hoped that law enforcement, paramedics and fire services would attend this scene and thus be too caught up to also be able to attend Columbine High School once their attack began. Klebold and Harris arrived at the school, parking in different areas. Their focus was the school cafeteria. The boys' initial plan was to detonate a huge propane-timed explosive which they had set in the cafeteria, then simply stand outside and shoot any survivors who emerged from the wreckage of the school. The bomb that they had set in the school's cafeteria would have been powerful enough to reduce the school to rubble and would have killed up to around 650 staff and pupils. Unfortunately for Eric and Dylan, but fortunately for everyone else, the bomb failed to go off. Dylan walked to Eric's car, and they both calmly walked into the cafeteria with the duffel bags containing their propane bombs. They placed the bags amongst other students' bags, which were left in a pile as the students attended lunch. Their devices were set to detonate at 11:17 a.m. The boys then retreated back to their cars, awaiting the blast, and preparing to finish off the survivors. You see, in Eric and Dylan's plan, their cars were the perfect spot to fire on any survivors emerging from the blast, as they would be fairly anonymous and difficult to spot by eyewitnesses. From there, they could easily drive away and either go into hiding or flee the country to a location with no extradition agreement with the United States. That's if they were even identified as the perpetrators of the attacks, of course, as the blast would make it difficult to identify all the bodies, and authorities and families would assume the boys were included in the dead. Eric and Dylan thought it was the perfect crime. While walking back to his car, Eric ran into his friend, Brooks Brown. Brooks quizzed Eric about why he had not attended a school test earlier that morning. Eric simply replied, "It doesn't matter anymore, Brooks. I like you now. Get out of here. Go home." For clarity, Eric and Brooks had a history. 1 year prior to the massacre at Columbine, Brown and Harris had a falling out when Harris threw a block of ice at his car, chipping Brown's windshield. This incident had seemingly grew from a small disagreement. You see, at this point, Brooks gave Eric a ride to school each day. Brooks was often late, however, and this made Eric more and more angry until he couldn't keep it inside anymore, and he lost it with Brooks, throwing the ice at his car. Shortly after the incident, Brown discovered that Harris had also posted a death threat directed towards him on a webpage that he had created. On his webpage, Harris wrote out a fantasy where he planned to plant explosives throughout Littleton and begin shooting people as they ran through the streets in panic. He also described a shootout with police. "I don't care if I live or die," Harris wrote. "All I want to do is kill and injure as many of you as I can, especially Brooks Brown." Brown had showed his parents the webpage that also featured descriptions of pipe bombs Harris and Klebold claimed to be making. The Browns filed a report with the sheriff's department, and according to Brooks' father, Randy Brown, the department said they had enough evidence to begin drafting an affidavit for a search warrant on Harris's home. But the warrant was never issued. The cafeteria bombs failed to explode. Both Klebold and Harris waited for a time before walking into the school and initiating their Plan B. Both were heavily armed and carefully positioned themselves, preparing to open fire. Klebold and Harris had also left bombs with timers in their cars, which were set to go off once they went back into the school. These bombs also failed to detonate, however. From their position at the top of the steps overlooking the cafeteria, they began shooting at students. Eric could be heard shouting to Klebold, "Go! Go!" Their first victims were 17-year-old Rachel Scott, who was sat on the grass outside eating lunch with her friend Richard Castaldo. Rachel was shot 4 times by Eric and died instantly. Richard was shot 8 times, but he survived, although paralyzed from the waist down. Students Daniel Roborough, Sean Graves and Lance Kirklin walked outside on their way to the smokers area, and all three were shot and dropped to the ground. 5 students sitting on the grass to the west of the steps were also gunned down as they began to run. Michael Johnson suffered a gunshot wound but was able to reach a storage shed where he took cover. Mark Taylor suffered a debilitating gunshot wound and fell to the ground, unable to flee with those around him. Klebold then went back down the steps and shot Daniel Roborough and Lance Kirklin again at close range. Daniel was killed instantly, but Lance luckily survived. Klebold then walked back and joined Eric at the top of the outside steps. 17-year-old Anne-Marie Hochhalter was shot multiple times as she tried to run for cover, leaving her paralyzed. Witnesses heard one of the gunmen shout, "This is what we always wanted to do. This is so awesome." Initially, some of the students inside the school believed that seniors were playing some sort of end-of-year prank or setting off firecrackers. However, it soon became apparent that this was no prank. Eric and Dylan were running amok and randomly shooting whoever was in their sights. They were both also throwing pipe bombs, although very few of them would actually detonate. At around 11:22, Sheriff's Deputy Neil Gardner, the assigned resource officer to Columbine, was called to the senior parking lot following reports of shots being fired. Around the same time, a 911 call was received from a Columbine High School student who reported that a girl was injured in the school's south lower parking lot. After realizing the seriousness of the situation and that it wasn't a senior prank, several of the school's custodial staff started directing students to get down and hide under tables and desks. School shootings were not commonplace at this time, and there were no shooting drills or plans in place for this kind of scenario, although Columbine would soon become the benchmark. Deputy Paul Smoker, a motorcycle patrolman for the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, heard on his radio about a girl down at Columbine High School, and he radioed dispatch to say that he was responding and making his way to the school. Teacher Patty Nielsen was working as a hall monitor at the time the events unfolded when she heard a commotion outside of the building. Again, thinking it was senior students messing around with firecrackers, she headed out to tell them to knock it off before one of the shooters opened fire at her. The gunfire caused glass and metal fragments to spray into the hallway, and Nielsen was hit by debris, suffering abrasions to her shoulder, forearm and knee. Right now, Harris and Klebold became distracted as they heard the siren of Deputy Gardner approaching. He quickly became their main target, and as soon as he stepped out of his patrol car, Harrison started shooting at him. Harris fired 10 rounds before his weapon jammed, and Gardner fired back, although neither Klebold or Harris were hit. Eric turned around and headed back into the school. It was clear to the students that this was a very serious situation. Many of the students tried to escape from the canteen area. Patty Nielsen climbed under a counter in the school library and called 911, while Deputy Gardner called for backup. This is Patty Nielsen's telephone call.
Jefferson County 911.
Yes, I am a teacher at Columbine High School. There is a student here with a gun. He has shot out a window. I believe one student has shot.
I've been Columbine High School.
I don't know what's in my shoulder. If it was just a last week too, but...
Okay, has anybody been injured, ma'am?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the school is in a panic, and I'm in the library. I've got students down under the table, kids! Heads under the table! Kids are screaming. Some of the teachers are, trying to take control of them. We need police here.
Okay, we're getting them there.
Please,
who is the student, ma'am?
I do not know who the student is.
Okay.
I saw a student outside. I was in hold of a gun. Okay. I was on hold and I saw a gun. I said, what's going on out there? And he said, oh, it's probably for video production. It's probably a joke. I said, well, I don't think that's a good idea. And I went walking outside.
I can see his dance.
See what was going on. He turned the gun straight at us and shot. And my God, the window went out. And the kid standing there with
that's
me, I think he got hit.
Okay.
Something in my shoulder.
Okay. We've got help on the way, ma'am.
Okay. Oh, God.
Stay in the line with me.
Oh, God. Okay, just stay down.
Do we know where he's at?
I'm sorry?
Do we know where he's at?
Okay. I'm in the library. He's upstairs. He's right outside of here.
He's outside?
He's outside of this hall.
Outside of a hall or outside?
In the hall.
Okay.
There are alarms and things going off. Now, smoke. My God, smoke is like coming into this room.
Okay.
I've got the kids under the table here. I don't know what's happening in the rest
okay.
of the building. We've also got smoke in the building. I don't know. I'm sure someone has to be calling 911 to
fight. Yes, we've got a lot of people on. Okay. I just want you to stay in the line with me. We need to know what's going on.
Okay.
Okay?
I am on the floor.
Okay. And you've
okay,
got the kids
in the
there.
Library, and I've got every student in this library on the floor. You better stay on the floor.
Is there any way you can lock the doors?
Smoke is coming in from out there, and I'm a little
okay.
afraid. The gun is right outside the library door, okay? I don't think I'm going to go out there.
Okay, you're at Columbine High School?
I got three children.
Okay, we got it.
Okay? I am going to go to the door to shut the door, okay? I've got the kids on the floor. I got all the kids in the library on the floor.
We have paramedics, we have fire, and we have police on route, okay, sir?
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
I can't believe he's not out of bullets. He just keeps shooting.
Okay, yeah, we've got a police officer on scene.
I thought it was...
Okay, just try and keep the kids in the library calm.
Yeah.
Is there any way you can block the door so no one can get in?
I do not.
Okay.
I guess I can try to go, but I mean, he's right outside that door. I'm afraid to go to the
door. That's okay.
That's where he is. I'm afraid
okay.
to go there. Okay?
That's okay.
Okay, I told the kids to get on the floor. I had them get under the table. All of the children are on the floor under the table. Yeah, they're all under the table.
Okay.
And
as long as we can just try and keep...
No one's saying a word.
Okay, as long as we can keep everyone there as calm as we can.
I hear some yelling out there going on right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, we've got alarms going off now as well.
Yeah, there's one. This room is filled with smoke.
Okay.
Okay.
Keep everyone low to the floor.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's up. Okay. Everyone stay on the floor. Stay on the floor. Stay under the table.
Okay. I don't know.
I didn't. I said, what is that kid got? He was outside at the time. And I was on call duty. I'm going to kill God. And he's crying. He's like, woo-hoo-hoo.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Things are being shut off. I do not know who the student was. I don't even think I saw him. He's wearing black. He didn't look very large. Male student. He was out there shooting. It looked like he was climbing out and shooting. And somebody, I said, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
I said, what's going on? He said, this is a cat gun. It's probably their video production. You know, they do these videos.
Right.
And the kids, I said, well, that's not, you know, a play gun, a real gun. I was going out there to say no.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, well, oh, my God, that was really close. That just rattled me.
Okay. What's your name, ma'am?
My name is Patty.
Patty?
Just yelling everybody get up right now. Please tell the library. Please tell everybody get up right now.
Okay.
Please don't hold on. Oh, I have him in the library shooting a student to the lady that I have in the library on the phone.
Okay, try and keep as many people down as we can. Okay. Do you know who he is? Okay.
By now, Jefferson County Detectives Scott Toborski and Paul Smoker had arrived at the scene and attended to two wounded students on the grass outside the cafeteria. Harris spotted both of them from a broken window and leaned out and started shooting at Deputy Smoker. Smoker fired back and Harris retreated back inside. Throughout, teacher Patty Nielsen continued her phone contact with the Jefferson County dispatcher, as he had previously, shouting at nearby students to get under the desks in between cries for help. You can at times hear the shooters shouting, hollering, making comments, and firing off explosives and gunshots in the background. The gunmen now turned their attention to students inside the library. They killed four students and injured another four more in the west area before they moved back towards the library entrance to the east side. There, they shot at display cabinets near the front door before shooting at eight more students, injuring five and killing three, before reloading their weapons and killing two more students in the center of the library. In a further 7.5 minute spree of gunfire, 10 people are killed and 12 are wounded in the library. At that exact moment, there were 56 people in the library in total, and only 34 escaped with their lives. During this killing spree, Eric's shotgun had kicked back and broken his nose when he crouched down to shoot Cassie Bernal at point-blank range. Blood poured from Harris's face. At 11:33 a.m., the Jefferson County SWAT team were called to the scene. Just before they arrived, the final student is shot dead at around 11:35 in the central library. Klebold and Harris then made their way to the science block. Witnesses recalled that although they were looking through the windows at the classrooms and making eye contact with terrified students, neither Klebold or Harris opened fire at them at this point or tried to break into the locked rooms. Instead, they both fired shots into empty rooms, potentially just to maintain fear of those within earshot. Klebold and Harris left the science block and went down into the cafeteria once again, where the now infamous CCTV footage shows Harris on the stairs firing shots at one of the bags containing one of their IEDs, but again, it failed to detonate. Had this exploded, both Harris and Klebold would have been killed by the blast. The pair then drank from bottles that had been left by fleeing students. A witness that was hiding in the cafeteria overheard one of the shooters saying, "Today the world is going to come to an end. Today is the day that we die." A somewhat grandiose and narcissistic statement. Harris and Klebold were in the cafeteria for around 2.5 minutes and eventually managed to partially detonate one of their bombs. It didn't cause a big explosion, but does cause a fire that activates the sprinkler system. At 11:52 a.m., Jefferson County Under Sheriff John Dunaway arrived at the command post and authorized SWAT teams to make an immediate entry into the school and end the situation at any cost. Eric and Dylan now seemed to be aimlessly wandering around the school. Their plan hadn't gone as anticipated, and they had to think on their feet. At 12:05 p.m., the shooting from the library towards officers stopped between 12:05 and 12:07. It's speculated that when seeing the mass of police officers gathering outside the school, they realized that it was all over. They had no escape plan, and going to jail was not an option for either of them. At approximately 12:07 p.m., Eric Harris leaned up against a bookshelf and positioned his Savage 67H pump-action shotgun with the stock between his legs. He placed the barrel inside of his mouth and pulled the trigger, blowing out the back of his head and killing himself instantly. Dylan Klebold got down onto his knees next to Eric. He lit a petrol bomb and threw it. He then aimed his Tech-9 semi-automatic handgun at his left temple and pulled the trigger. A bullet sliced through his brain, but he didn't die instantly. He took several minutes to die as his lungs filled with blood, and he convulsed uncontrollably, effectively drowning in his own blood. Patrick Ireland, who was hiding inside the library, would later state that he could hear Dylan coughing, gargling, and spluttering after he had shot himself. It was all over, for Eric and Dylan, at least. The final death toll of the shooting was 12 students and one teacher, who had all lost their life, sadly, on this day. 21 were injured, and some of those had life-changing injuries. The psychological trauma caused by the Columbine massacre continues to this day. Eric was responsible for 8 of the 13 confirmed deaths, including that of a teacher, while Dylan was liable for the remaining 5. The media coverage of the events was worldwide and extensive. Over the coming days and weeks, there was much speculation as to the killer's motives, their backgrounds, and what triggered the events. Some true, some entirely false. The killers were dead, but blame needed to be assigned. So what made these two seemingly ordinary teenage boys turn into cold-blooded and maniacal killers? Many people have come forward over the years. Medical professionals, psychologists, law enforcement professionals, people who knew the killers personally and their families, and they have all put forward their own theories. But there has also been a lot of false information relating to this incident. Eric David Harris was born on April the 9th, 1981, in Wichita, Kansas. He was the second son of Wayne and Catherine Harris. Wayne Harris served in the United States Air Force, and due to this, the family moved around a lot. The Harris family finally settled in Littleton, Colorado, after Wayne's retirement from the service in 1993. Many witnesses and family friends attested that in his early life, Eric was just a regular kid who had a good relationship with his older brother Kevin and both of his parents. There was nothing in Eric's demeanor or behavior in these early years to indicate what he would become. When the family moved to Colorado, Eric attended Ken Cale Middle School, where he would meet Dylan Klebold at age 11. The pair became fast friends and very close. They spent a lot of time together. They both shared a passion for computers and video games, with Eric in particular becoming obsessed with the computer game Doom. In 2009, Wayne Harris said that Eric subscribed to a number of gun magazines as a teenager, but this was because he wanted to learn about them to help him play Doom. The two later went on to attend Columbine High School, where they were both part of a close-knit group of friends that included Brooks Brown and Nate Dykeman. During Eric's freshman year, he met Tiffany Tyfer and took her to the homecoming dance. Tyfer, though, would refuse to go out with Eric again. In response to this, Eric staged a fake suicide by laying on the ground outside Tyfer's home and covered himself with fake blood. During this period, Eric also became increasingly erratic in his behavior. In 2017, Dylan's mother, Sue Klebold, recalled that back in 1996, when the boys were just 15, they both took part in a local soccer team. Following a losing game, both Dylan and Eric walked over to the Klebolds, who had been watching the game. Sue went on, "Before we could congratulate the boys on a good game, Eric lashed out at Dylan in an angry outburst for losing the game. He screamed with veins popping out of his forehead and spittle slathering all over Dylan's face as he quietly absorbed the verbal outpour. Other teammates and parents fell silent and stared at Eric as his parents silently flanked him and slowly guided him away." In October 1997, Eric and Dylan started working at Blackjack Pizza, a local delivery restaurant where Eric held the position of shift leader, while Dylan was a kitchen cook. It was at Blackjack Pizza where the boys purchased the Tech 9 semi-automatic pistol that they would use in the massacre. Their colleague, Philip Duran, put them in touch with Mark Maines, who sold them the gun illegally for $500. They were underage at the time, and Maines was eventually sentenced to 6 years in prison for the offence, whereas Duran was sentenced to 4.5 years for setting up the deal. The other three weapons were purchased by Robin Anderson, who was a close friend of Dylan's. Robin purchased the weapons at the Tanner Gun Show in December of 1998 from unlicensed sellers. Because Anderson purchased the guns for someone else, the transition constituted an illegal straw purchase. However, due to a loophole in Colorado law at the time, which meant that someone could purchase a rifle and gift it to someone legally, Anderson was never charged with a crime. The boys also built their first pipe bomb in October of 1997. Eric, Dylan, and another close friend, Zach Heckler, were also suspended from Columbine High School for breaking into another student locker at the time. Then, on January the 30th, 1998, Eric and Dylan were arrested for breaking into a van and stealing computer equipment and tools. Both boys pled guilty to felony theft and were ordered to attend the juvenile diversion program. As part of the program, the boys had to attend mandatory anger management classes. Both boys excelled on the program, to the relief of both of their parents, and they were released early due to how well that they performed on the program. Just a month later, however, sheriff deputies found a pipe bomb near the home of Eric Harris. Eric's parents were becoming increasingly concerned about his anger issues by this time, and he started seeing a psychiatrist. Eric was prescribed the antidepressant medication Zoloft by the psychiatrist. This is a brand name for sertraline. Eric's father, Wayne, also started to keep a journal detailing his son's behavior. A significant event during this time was the aforementioned fight between Eric and Brooks Brown. By April 1998, Eric began his own personal journal and started outlining plans for an attack on the school. The date of the attack was set for April the 19th, 1999, although this date was later changed the week before the attack to the 20th. It has always been claimed that the original date was planned to coincide with the anniversaries of the Oklahoma City bombing and the government fiasco in Waco, Texas in 1993. It is still not entirely clear as to why Klebold and Harris changed it to the next day. Some speculation is that it was to coincide with the birthday of Adolf Hitler. Hitler and his regime was something that the boys had a secretive and shared interest in. Eric even posted some rants on his website in German. But the speculation as to why the date was changed to April the 20th is just that. Speculation. Several months after being prescribed Zoloft, Eric complained to his psychiatrist that he was experiencing adjustment issues to the drug, so his medication was switched to Luvox. This is fairly significant information, as Luvox was primarily prescribed for cases of obsessive-compulsive disorder, which was something that Eric did not suffer with. Further, Luvox was believed to be associated with violent behavior and suicidal thinking in children and teenagers. It was these side effects coinciding with the school shooting which would lead to Luvox being removed from sale in the US in 2002. In the months before the attack, Eric and Dylan recorded some disturbing videos of themselves, both for school and personal projects, but also what is believed to be a video manifesto prior to the massacre, which is now known as the Basement Tapes. Whilst many of the boys' videos are available online, particularly the school project film which portrays both boys as hitmen for hire, the Basement Tapes have never been released by law enforcement authorities. It is not known why. Just a few days prior to the school shooting, Eret met with a recruitment officer to look at the possibility of a career in the Marines. Although Eric was ultimately rejected due to his failure to disclose the antidepressant medication he was taking, he was not accepted into the military. The rejection from the military had not reached Eric by the time of the massacre, so it's extremely unlikely that this would have been any sort of deciding factor in why Eric carried out the attack. Dylan Bennett Klebold was born in Lakewood, Colorado on September 11, 1981. He was the younger son of Sue and Tom Klebold and had one older brother, Byron. Both his parents were well respected in the community, where Tom worked as a geophysicist and Sue worked with disabled people at a local community college. Dylan was a very intelligent child and was part of the CHIPS program, where he attended Governor's Ranch Elementary School. The program supported gifted and talented children, enabling them to reach their full potential. In Sue Klebold's book, A Mother's Reckoning, she said that he was easy to raise and a pleasure to be with. He was a child who had always made his parents proud. Sue and Tom Klebold called Dylan their sunshine boy. Dylan met and befriended Eric Harris when he moved on to Ken Carroll Middle School. Dylan was very shy and quiet, and he found it very hard to fit in with other children. He got lucky when he found Eric, though. He found someone he connected with and had a lot in common with. They became best friends. When Dylan progressed onto Columbine High School, his path wasn't too dissimilar to Eric's. Gone were the days of advanced learning programs, and his grades had slipped slightly. He grew to become an average student. After Dylan and Eric were suspended for breaking the locker combinations of fellow students and then arrested for the theft of computer equipment from the van, Dylan and Eric's mothers both agreed to try and keep them apart. This was an easier decision for Sue Klebold to make, compared to Catherine Harris, as Sue was growing a little wary of Eric. Of Dylan's three closest friends, Nate, Zach and Eric, it was Eric who was the least engaging with Sue and her husband. He was the quietest, although very respectful. But Sue had noticed his temper grown in recent years and felt that he might have anger issues. Catherine, Eric's mother on the other hand, knew Eric didn't have many close friends and was very reluctant at first to split Dylan and Eric up. She also shared her husband's views that Eric was blamed for things that were not always his fault. Like the Brooks Brown drama, for example. Both Wayne and Catherine felt that the situation was made worse and aggravated by Brooks, not Eric. Wayne Harris would write about these thoughts in his 1998 journal. The reality of keeping Eric and Dylan apart, though, could not be enforced, and gradually their friendship returned to how it had always been. Dylan, too, started a journal in 1997, and on July the 23rd of that year, he made his first entries about killing. He was also becoming increasingly irritable, depressed and unmotivated, and his deteriorating mental health was visible on his journal pages. Even though Eric had temper outbursts, the boys were arrested and school suspensions occurred, there was never anything to indicate that Dylan and Eric were planning a mass murder. If someone had read their journals, however, that might have been very different. Although Dylan's parents were concerned at times, they put it down to normal adolescent behaviour. After all, they had been through similar things with Dylan's older brother Byron, finding drugs in his bedroom, for example. Sue and Tom were particularly reassured when just 3 months before the Columbine High School massacre, Dylan was released early from the diversion programme. Dylan's counsellor even wrote that Dylan is a bright young man with a bright future ahead of him, which was cause for pride with Sue and Tom. Things seemed to be going in the right direction for Dylan, and the whole Klebold family even drove to Arizona to pick out Dylan's room on campus at the University of Arizona, where he was due to attend the following September, majoring in computer science. The Klebold family knew, though, that Dylan was painfully shy and suffered from very low self-esteem. There is one particular incident that his mother shared in 2017 that occurred when they were at a fast food restaurant. There was a group of high school kids sitting down at the table across the room from Dylan and his parents. Sue said that Dylan was incredibly anxious and wanted to leave immediately. Dylan felt that the teenagers were laughing at him and making comments at his expense. Sue said, however, that they were not paying any attention to Dylan at all. She wasn't even sure that they had even seen him. Yet he was sure that they were. A real insight into Dylan's true mental state and violent fantasies occurred just a few weeks before the attack on Columbine, when he handed in a school report that was so graphically violent the teacher alerted his parents. Even though Sue and Tom questioned Dylan, that they were fine and accepting of the explanation that it was just a story that he had written. All teenagers have wild imaginations, right? Well, the story was about a lone warrior dressed in a black trench coat who, in graphic detail, would beat, stab, and shoot to death a group of high school kids, then set off a bomb to divert the attention of the police. 3 days before the massacre, Dylan dressed up in a smart black tuxedo and took his close friend Robin Anderson to the Columbine High School prom. Yes, the same Robin Anderson who supplied Dylan and Eric with three of their four firearms. Dylan's father, Tom, followed him around the house filming him as he got ready and later posed for a number of photographs. Tom was very proud of his son that day. Robin and Dylan were not romantically involved, though. Robin jokingly boasts at the time that she had convinced her friend Dylan, who hates dances and has never had a date, let alone a girlfriend, to go with her to the prom. She saw it as a challenge. She stated that I'm either really cute or just really persuasive. Dylan, along with 12 others, went to the dance via limousine. His friend, Nate Dykeman, told reporters after the attack that nothing seemed unusual about that night and that everything went perfect. They all had so much fun. There really were no clear signs that, despite Dylan suffering from low self-esteem and was experiencing severe depression, that he would go on to shoot up a school just days later. Dylan hid his anguish well, so well that his closest friends and family suspected nothing was wrong at all. In the aftermath of the shooting, it soon became apparent who the perpetrators of the attack were. A tornado of untruths and speculations printed in the newspapers and media, lots of which that has now been proven to be untrue, filled the columns and news stories. The extent of Dylan and Eric's plan was this. For over a year, they had been planning the attack, but they hadn't initially planned to enter the school and randomly shoot people. They planned a bombing on a massive scale, and if they had wired up the bombs they planted in the cafeteria correctly, they would have wiped out 600 people. Then they had planned to wait outside for the explosion and shoot any students who managed to escape. This would be followed by the detonation of the bombs that they had prepared in their cars, with the intention of killing even more students, law enforcement, emergency services personnel, and reporters. Their hope was that all of this would be aired live on TV. Their fantasy was to create a living nightmare, a nightmare so devastating that the entire world would know their names and they would live forever in infamy. But when the bombs failed to detonate, they had to think on the spot and come up with a plan B. It's their plan B that they put to force on that day in April. Some of the truths and lies about the boys on that day were that Eric and Dylan were loners, weirdos, harshly bullied, and members of a goth group called the Trenchcoat Mafia. Eric Harris was actually a confident man and had plenty of friends at school. Dylan Klebold was slightly awkward and less confident, yes, but was not bullied extensively any more than any others at Columbine High School. I mentioned this as Dave Cullen, in his book Columbine, seems to lean heavily on bullying being the ultimate motive for the massacre, but it really wasn't. Dylan also had a good group of friends. Both Dylan and Eric attended football games, dances, and school plays, and despite initial reports, neither of them were linked to the Trenchcoat Mafia or any other gang of goth culture within the school. In fact, the group known as the Trenchcoat Mafia were actually a few years older than Eric and Dylan, and all its members had graduated and left Columbine a number of years earlier. This rumour seemingly started by a phone call that Eric Harris's own father Wayne made to 911 on the morning of the massacre. Wayne Harris had told the call handler that he thinks the perpetrator of the attack was his son, and that his son was a member of the Trenchcoat Mafia. Whilst Eric and Dylan did regularly wear long black trench coats, they were not part of that group. Another myth that emerged was that Eric and Dylan targeted specific groups and minorities during the attack. The killings were actually indiscriminate, and both Dylan and Eric had no individual or specific targets, such as minorities, jocks, or Christians. Eric's friends actually described him as a sports enthusiast, and two of his friends were Asian and African American. But Dylan is reported to have made a racial remark at a black student and told all jocks to stand up in the library. This, however, is true. However, they did not target people specifically. Additionally, it was initially reported that 17-year-old Cassie Bernal was hiding under a table when Eric Harris approached her and asked her whether or not she believed in God. When she replied yes, he shot her in the face at point-blank range. This prompted Christians to hail Bernal as a martyr for her faith. However, multiple witnesses' testimony and cross-examination reveals that Bernal was not asked anything before she was shot at all. Another student, Valine Schnur, was the individual who was asked if she believed in God by Eric. Schnur actually survived the shooting. Despite this explanation, the story of Cassie Bernal being a martyr persisted for decades after the massacre. Another rumour that emerged after the massacre was that Eric had accidentally left deliberate clues about what was due to happen in the hope that someone would find them and stop him from doing what him and Dylan had planned, because one half of him wanted to commit mass murder, but the other half did not. This is a gross falsehood and almost Hollywood in its fiction. The rumour arose due to Eric having a poster in his bedroom which was visible towards the end of the basement tapes. The poster was of a bomb with a lit fuse and an arrow pointing to Columbine High School with the word CLUE written next to it. No one really knows whether it was made to let Eric's parents know that their son was involved in the attack, or whether it was a final middle finger to those around him for not seeing that he and Dylan were planning this for over a year, and that he was able to plan this under everyone's noses. It might have also just been a dumb teenage joke. The day before the attack, Eric uploaded a message to the school's computers which read, "I'm Eric Harris. Today is my last day on Earth. Be prepared." Eric likely knew this wouldn't be seen before their attack, so may have been left as a calling card or a way of saying, "I did this." Psychologically speaking, it's a message of power and control. Following the events of April 20, people asked if the attack could have been prevented. In the immediate aftermath, those who were acquainted with Eric described him as a well-spoken, articulate, and nice person. However, those who knew him were also not entirely surprised that he was involved in the massacre, claiming that he was displaying increasingly unpredictable behavior in the run-up to the attack. This is also echoed in some of Sue Klebold's comments made in her book, A Mother's Reckoning. Dylan's involvement, on the other hand, was a complete shock to those who knew him, and even his parents maintained that they had no idea that their son was so troubled. Both boys had been in trouble, sure, but nothing serious. Just slightly wayward and common teenage behaviours, and absolutely nothing that would indicate a mentality to want to kill or harm others. But after viewing the basement tapes and reading Eric and Dylan's journals, both sets of parents and law enforcement investigated revealed that they were no ordinary troubled teenagers. The anger and resentment that they displayed was so strong and hate-filled. Eric's journal starts with a declaration, "I hate the fucking world." Dylan's journal revealed that he was not just a hapless follower of Eric, who just tagged along, but there was a dark and disturbed side to him that few had ever witnessed. Dylan was a very, very angry man, who wanted to hurt people, and he showed it in his words and body language. Dylan and Eric both ranted about their hatred for schoolmates and revealed violent drawings and messages, as well as feelings of frustration and love. The journals also gave an insight into the boy's mental states. They revealed the meticulous planning that had gone into the attack that they called NBK. Some entries read in chilling vernacular. In October 1998, just 6 months before the school massacre, Eric wrote the following passage. "Once I finally start my killing, keep this in mind. There are probably about 100 people max in the school alone who I do not want to die. The rest must fucking die." In a diary entry for the day of the shoot in April 20th, 1999, Dylan specified precise details of the massacre, beginning with a 6 a.m. meeting between the two killers, followed by a 10:30 a.m. setup and an 11:12 a.m. gear up. In an entry for 11:16 a.m., the time of the shooting, Dylan simply wrote, "Ha ha ha." Both killers had to-do lists, and it ticked off all of their requirements for the massacre. Eric had also documented precise plans for their escape after the massacre. Eric wrote that if they survived, they would escape to a country where they could not be extradited back to the United States. This alone evidences that what happened on the day was not their plan or intention. To kill themselves was their final option, when they ran out of all other options. Further, Eric wrote that if they could not make it to a non-extradition country, then they would crash a plane into New York City in a chilling pre-9/11 event. In addition to Eric and Dylan's journals, extract from Eric's father's journals revealed that he was not particularly concerned with his son's behavior. Wayne Harris goes on to state that he feels his family is victimized at times, and how he doesn't feel that it's fair that they, or in particular Eric, gets accused every time something happens, referring again particularly to Brooks Brown, who he feels is out to get Eric. What Wayne Harris nor anyone else knew is that just over a year before the events at Columbine High School unfolded, investigator Mark Guerra had realized Eric may be a threat after he discovered evidence that Eric was building pipe bombs and posting dozens of pages of obscene threats on the internet. And after putting all these evidence together, he wrote an affidavit outlining his fears and applied for a warrant to search Eric's house. This would have certainly prevented Columbine and destroyed Harris and Klebold's plan, especially as all the explosives and weaponry for their planned NBK was stored in Eric's bedroom. But in a devastating outcome of fate, the search warrant was never taken before a judge. Following the massacre, the law enforcement authorities rediscovered the affidavit and panicked, then trying to keep it hidden. The truth about the affidavit did come out, although it was many years later. In February 2016, Sue Klebold released her book, A Mother's Reckoning. In it, she describes that she and her husband both had failed to realize how unhappy and mentally ill their son was. She goes on to state that they failed to see obvious clues that were there all along with Dylan. In reading this book twice, however, I personally cannot accept her analysis of the events. There is nothing in the book that would lead anyone, in my view, to think there was something seriously wrong with their son. I think Sue is a brave woman for coming forward and speaking publicly about Dylan and the events surrounding the Columbine High School massacre. However, I sense she feels that she has a sense of duty to the public to accept responsibility for her son's actions and to admit that she failed as a mother. I encourage you all to read this memoir and collect your own thoughts. Sue and Tom divorced in 2014 after 43 years of marriage. Their decision came after they admitted that they no longer had any common interests, opinions, or goals, and that how they wanted to deal with the outcome of Columbine moving forward was completely different. Eric's family have never spoken publicly about their son and have refused many interviews. Rumors emerged online that they moved away to rural Washington State to avoid the media and public after the events of Columbine. But I can confirm, without giving anything personal away, that they do actually remain together and are still living in Colorado. Eric's older brother eventually followed in his father's footsteps and joined the military, serving his country in Afghanistan. It was concluded that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were both radically different individuals. but both had complex, if perhaps opposite, mental health conditions. Dylan was deeply depressed, suicidal, and easily influenced. Though he had a lot of love in his heart, his journals revealed, but this only conflicted with his self-loathing and resentment of everyone and everything. Dylan needed help and support, and the last thing that he needed was to be guided by someone like Eric Harris, a cold, calculated, and manipulative individual who wanted to hurt people and see the world around him burn. Eric stated in one of his home videos that he was spending less time with his family to make the process of cutting them off easier. Eric's final journal entry 7 days before the massacre is a very close representation of how he truly thinks and feels. Eric was a man who had written of rape and mass murder in the most disgusting ways, yet in his final post he reveals that he's just upset and unloved. Many have speculated that Dylan didn't want to commit suicide at home, but taking part in the Columbine massacre was the perfect excuse to end his life. Though Dylan had very dark thoughts, it's unlikely that without Eric he would have acted on them, although we will never really know for sure. When Eric and Dylan, two deeply disturbed minds, came together, the result was catastrophic. It resulted in the most infamous school shooting the world has ever seen, and whilst there have since been school shootings that are considered much more barbaric or with higher body counts, Columbine lives in the national psyche as the benchmark for what all other school shootings will be measured against. To date, there is no definitive answer for why Eric and Dylan committed the school shooting. Some are afraid to admit that there may not be one specific reason or root cause. Columbine High School reopened in the fall of 1999 and remains open to this day. In closing of this episode, I'd like to leave you with one of my favorite speeches. It's by a man far more eloquent than I can ever be, who sums up the state of violence in our country, our society, United States, and Western society as a whole. Even though the speech was given in 1967, it still remains highly relevant today. Please give attention to the speech titled "The Mindless Menace of Violence" by Robert F. Kennedy.
In a time of sorrow, it is not a day for politics. I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. It is not the concern of any one race. The victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why? What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Whenever any American's life is taken by another American unnecessarily, whether it is done in the name of the law or in defiance of the law, by one man or by a gang, in cold blood or in passion, in an attack of violence or in response to violence, whenever we tear at the fabric of our lives, which another man has painfully and clumsily woven for himself, and his children. Whenever we do this, then the whole nation is degraded. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Yet we seemingly tolerate a rising level of violence that ignores our common humanity and our claims to civilization alike. We calmly accept newspaper reports of civilian slaughter in far-off lands. We glorify killing on movie and television screens, and we call it entertainment. We'd make it easier for men of all shades of sanity to acquire weapons and ammunition that they desire. Too often we honor swagger and bluster and the wielders of force. Too often we excuse those who are willing to build their own lives on the shattered dreams of other human beings. Some Americans who preach nonviolence abroad fail to practice it here at home. Some accuse others of rioting and inciting riots, have by their own conduct invited them. Some look for scapegoats, others look for conspiracies. But this much is clear: violence breeds violence, repression breeds retaliation, and only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls. For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit by denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man amongst other men. And this, too, afflicts us all. For when you teach a man to hate and to fear his brother, when you teach that he is a lesser man because of his color or his beliefs or the policies that he pursues, when you teach that those who differ from you threaten your freedom or your job or your home or your family, then you also learn to confront others, not as fellow citizens, but as enemies, to be met not with cooperation, but with conquest, to be subjugated and to be mastered. We learn at the last to look at our brothers as alien men with whom we share a city, but not a community. Men bound to us in common dwelling, but not in a common effort. We learn to share only a common fear, only a common desire to retreat from each other, only a common impulse to meet disagreement with force. For all this, there are no final answers for those of us who are American citizens. Yet we know what we must do, and that is to achieve true justice among all of our fellow citizens. The question is not what programs we should seek to enact. The question is whether we can find in our own midst and in our own hearts that leadership of humane purpose that will recognize the terrible truths of our existence. We must admit the vanity of our false distinctions, the false distinctions among men, and learn to find our own advancement in search for the advancement of all. We must admit to ourselves that our children's future cannot be built on the misfortune of another's. We must recognize that this short life can neither be ennobled or enriched by hatred or by revenge. Our lives on this planet are too short. The work to be done is too great to let this spirit flourish any longer in this land of ours. Of course, we cannot banish it with a program, nor with a resolution. But we can perhaps remember, if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as do we, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and in happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment that they can. Surely this bond of common fate, surely this bond of common goals can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn at the least to look around at those of us, of our fellow men, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our hearts brothers and countrymen once again. Tennyson wrote in Ulysses, "That which we are, one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Thank you very much.
Good night, my friends.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.